This is Polyphonic Press, the podcast where two music fans pick a classic album completely at random. Using the patented random album generator, they are given an album to review from a curated list of over 1,000 classic releases, spanning multiple genres. And now onto the show. Here are your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's not waste any time. We've got the patented random album generator right in front of us here. So let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. And the album we're going to be listening to is The Beatles, Please Please Me.
Okay.
All right. This is their debut album. I know that. This is what it says on allmusic.com. It says, once Please Please Me rocketed to number one, the Beatles rushed to deliver a debut album, bashing out Please Please Me in a day. Decades after its release, the album still sounds fresh precisely because of its intense origins. As the songs rush past, it's easy to get wrapped up in the sound of the record itself without realizing how the album effectively summarizes the band's eclectic influences. Naturally, the influences shine through their covers, all of which are unconventional and illustrate the group's superior taste. There's a love of girl groups, vocal harmonies, sophisticated pop craft, schmaltz, R&B, and hard-driving rock and roll, which is enough to make Please Please Me impressive. But what makes it astonishing is how these elements converge in the originals. I Saw Her Standing There is one of the best rockers, yet it has surprising harmonies and melodic progressions. Misery and There's a Place grow out of the girl group tradition without being tied to it. A few of their originals, such as Do You Want to Know a Secret and the pleasantly lit P.S. I Love You, have dated slightly, but endearingly so. Since they're infused with cheerful innocence and enthusiasm, there is an innocence to Please Please Me. The Beatles may have played notoriously rough dives in Hamburg, but the only way you could tell that on their first album was how the constant gigging turned the group into a tight, professional band that could run through their set list at the top at the drop of a hat with boundless energy. It's no surprise that Lennon had shouted himself hoarse by the end of the session, barely getting through Twist and Shout, the most famous single take in rock history. He simply got caught up in the music, just like generations of listeners did. Okay. So yes, this is their debut album. It was released on the 22nd of March, 1963. And the genres are Mersey Beat, rock and roll, and pop. The label is Parlophone and produced by George Martin. And if you're listening along, which we really encourage you to do, the album has 14 songs on it, and it's divided pretty evenly, 7 and 7. So the album starts with the song I Saw Her Standing There, and side one ends with the title track, Please Please Me. So if you want to stop halfway through, and we'll have a discussion at the halfway point. And I've linked the album in the show notes to both Spotify and Apple Music, so you can get it on your preferred streaming service. And without further ado, here is the first song on Please Please Me called I Saw Her Standing There. So here we go. Okay, and ending side one with the title track, Please Please Me. Yeah, it's so funny and cool to hear how, like, just how tight they were this early on. And I think, you know, it's just from playing live for so many years leading up to this in Hamburg and just playing like 8 hours a night.
Yeah, they were just, barely had any time off.
Yeah. They were just so tight, and like there's no debut. Like we were saying last week about Dire Straits. I mean, for a debut album for a band to be this tight is pretty unusual. And it's pretty obvious that there was something special about the Beatles even early on in their career, you know.
Yeah. Material wise, I think some of this, like, I'm not as attached to a lot of the songs on this one as I am on later albums. Like, I'm really attached to, like, you know, the Rubber Soul, Revolver, and anything after that, where it's like everything just seems a little bit more methodical and, well, I guess it's more experimental, but it's also, I don't know, the song crafting, just like they've really came into their own on those albums. This one, there's a couple of, you know, there's a couple of good songs on here and everything like that, but, you know, they're mostly the well-known ones.
Yeah. What I'm saying is you can see the potential.
Oh yeah. I mean, they're definitely tight. They're, they've got, you know, they got their 10,000 hours in.
Mm-hmm. Very early on. Yeah.
Very early on. But, their creative peak hadn't yet come.
No, absolutely. Yeah. No, I agree. But, you know, they were sort of unique in that, you know, I guess Buddy Holly wrote his own songs, but they didn't really rely on outside songwriters. They recorded covers, but they weren't relying on outside song. Like, you have, well, for this album, later George Harrison started writing, but for this album, all the originals were written by John Lennon and Paul McCartney, which that was pretty unusual at the time. Usually you would have a band, even like a rock and roll band, would not necessarily be writing their own songs.
No, it was sort of the domain of the songwriter was separate from the performer in a lot of ways. And the Beatles were one of the ones that came along and really changed that. But yeah, I've mentioned it before, but on the, you know, when the Beatles hit the Ed Sullivan show, it was just an explosion of music. Didn't seem to be some sort of like magical, ethereal concept. It was suddenly apparent that almost anybody could do it.
Yeah. I think part of
the cloak was removed a bit.
Well, yeah. And I think part of that too was, you know, they seem to be like a group of friends. Up until that point, it had mostly been like you would have like singing groups.
Right.
And, or if it was a rock and roll band, it would be Bill Haley and the Comets, yep. Buddy Holly and the Crickets. This was the Beatles. There was no obvious leader. We're a group of equals, and it's sort of like, okay, this is, and you're right, like when Ed Sullivan hit, it's like, oh, I could get you know, three of my friends and we could do this.
Yeah, it was just music was presented, like, up to that point, to in, for the most part, you would go see a movie like an Elvis movie or something like that, and you know, it would be Elvis singing. And there's like this orchestra music being pumped in from behind somewhere. And you don't see the musicians for a lot of things. I mean, occasionally one rock and roll movie would come about and there's Bill Haley and the Comets on stage in the corner of a room or doing something. But that wasn't the way it was presented most of the time. It was generally almost seemed like this thing that just, you know, oh, only a very select few people get to do this sort of life or something like that. And then after 1964, there's this huge explosion of garage bands and everything. And many of them became really popular, but many of them didn't. But I'm still digging through the deluge of stuff from the psychedelic era and stuff like that that came after. You know, the Beatles influenced all of them in one way or another. And, you know, they're all seem to be of that age where they watched, you know, Ed Sullivan on that day in 1964, whether or not, you know, even in Britain and stuff like that, like a lot of these bands, you know, well, the blues had a lot to do with it, but even just the Beatles sort of gave a lot of people permission to form a band in a lot of ways. It just, I don't want to say it took the magic away, because it didn't take the magic away, but it definitely took the cloak down.
If I were to compare it to something, it would almost be like, and this didn't happen until much later, but it was almost like when YouTube came along, suddenly all these aspiring filmmakers could see how they could do something. It's almost like that. It's like, oh, you know, people my age and people who, you know, or maybe a few years older, they're doing it, and I'm seeing how they're doing it.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like this thing that's out of your reach anymore. The more that, you know, something comes along that allows you to just, you know, piece it together in your mind how you could do this. It's just a lot of, you know, the blocks fall into their holes, and you know, can actually visualize yourself doing something. And the Beatles did that for a lot of people.
Yes, they did. Yeah, they did. Do you think, though, would something like that happen today? Like, do you think there would be...
Yeah, it seems almost like something needs to happen like that again, because, well, there's a lot of, like, aspiring rappers and stuff like that. But as opposed to actually having, like, a band together, I think it's almost like we've kind of stashed that all back in the hole again. Like being a musician doesn't seem to be, like, the aspirational thing that it was with a couple of previous generations. I mean, you can argue that, you know, being a DJ and being a rapper are, you know, I mean, it's a type of musician or something like that. But, I mean, actually... picking up an instrument. I mean, some people, you know, they learn it in band, and that's all cool and important. You know, being in band and in like high school and junior high and things like that is, it's a good window for a lot of people to figure out what they're doing, but there's not usually a lot of space for, well, from a rock and roll standpoint, there's not a lot of space for, like, you know, your guitar, your drums, your bass and stuff like that in that sort of a setup. And, yeah, we've kind of gotten away from that. I mean, if big band suddenly became a big thing again, that'd be cool too.
Yeah. And I've noticed that a lot of musicians, there are people who are making music and who are playing instruments, but there aren't, I've noticed, and it's not something I noticed. It was pointed out that when they said it seemed kind of like, yeah, there just aren't any bands anymore. It's mostly solo artists.
Yeah, mostly solo artists. It's like that cloak has been re-put on, like, you know, the cloak that the Beatles removed has been reapplied by the industry. It's become sort of like that magical music being pumped in from somewhere else, and the guy, as opposed to singing over it, they're generally rapping over it. That seems to be the only real difference.
Or if they are making more like rock stuff, it's not bands doing it really. It's like one, maybe two people sort of, like, just recording it piece by piece. Yeah. Well, I did manage to find a few facts about the album. So this, as it said in the initial review, is this album was recorded in a single day, over a 12-hour period, which sounds impressive, but really it's just their stage show, what they had at the time, and they just sort of ran through all the songs that they had.
And they still would have had to have a few multiple takes of some of these songs. Like, I'd have heard them too, So I've heard, I know Misery for, I've heard several false starts. So that's out there somewhere.
Yes, they, yeah, they recorded it over about 12 hours. And John Lennon's voice, he was actually fighting a cold at the time. And you can hear it, you can hear it on the song, Anna, Go to Him. You can really hear that he's, you know, congested. And by the end of the session, his voice was almost blown out and actually made this, the song, the closing track, Twist and Shout. That was the last song that was recorded, and actually made the song better because it has that sort of rock and roll edge. You know, he had laryngitis for a few days after, I think probably be, but it sounds great, you know? So, if anyone's listening out there, you know, try to get a cold if you want to sing, sing good.
No, I actually can't recommend that.
The other thing is the iconic cover that, you know, is a famous photograph almost didn't happen. Actually, George Martin was a member of the London Zoological Society, and he had the idea. He thought it would be a good idea to have the Beatles pose in the London Zoo outside of the insect house. That's a little too on the nose, but it's kind of a corny idea. But yeah, that was almost going to be the cover of the album.
It would have been almost like Pet Sounds, because that's had a strange cover too, with just the, you know. They're at a petting zoo and stuff like that. But, again, when something is sort of like entered the, zeitgeist or something like that, it's easy to accept it as it is. At least it is for me. So, you know, things that when you think about it, you realize are actually kind of a strange idea. But because it's just, that's the idea they went with, and it became so popular that you're just used to it. So that could have been what happened on that for that as well. But honestly, I think the angle with the mid-century staircase and them just looking down at you seems to be, that's pretty iconic too. And the fact that they revisited it for their greatest hits compilation. Around 1970.
Yeah. Well, that photo was initially going to be the cover of the Get Back album, which ended up being scrapped and then later came out as Let It Be. That's why they took that photo. It was useful to have that photo so they could have like the two albums come out as like one. The first half of their career and one for the second half, because their look drastically changed. But that was the initial idea, was to have that be the cover for the abandoned Get Back album. Another one was both Love Me Do and Please Please Me were released as singles and were also on the album, which was really unusual at the time. Usually you would have singles and then the album, and the single wouldn't appear on the album. It's very common now to have that, but back then, I guess they felt that it was cheating. Well, I guess buying a single was more common than it is now. So I guess to sort of have a single on an album, it's sort of like, well, we're kind of charging people for the same song twice.
Yeah, but they treated albums almost like a compilation at the time anyway. Like it was just a collection of songs that they did. And some of them were like, if you were Elvis or something like that, a lot of the songs on the album were hits anyway, just because he was so big. But yeah, it was definitely unusual. If you're actually going to put out an album, there might be a single come off the album, but for the most part, it was the single was a separate thing.
I think the thinking was like albums are more expensive, so we should have something, you know, less expensive for, you know, teenagers who, you know, don't have a lot of money. And albums and or LPs were more marketed towards like not richer people, but like
they were aimed at older people, generally people who are a little bit more established in their careers. And then, and for music, they wanted something that they could put on and not, you know, have to worry about. I mean, they still had to get up halfway through and turn it over, but beyond that, they could put it on and ignore it for about an hour.
And this actually wasn't the, this didn't become the standard debut album, for the Beatles across the world. It was in England, but in North America, and this is pretty common knowledge, but in North America, they had separate releases and separate albums because they were on a different label in the United States. They were on a label called VJ Records. And they sort of struck a deal with Capitol, which is EMI's American label. And for whatever reason, they had a different version of every album up until Rubber Soul. Rubber Soul was the first album that was released, you know, like this is
actually,
the album.
There was a couple of versions of that because I have a couple of, I have a version or a copy of Rubber Soul, and there's some songs that I know are part of the Rubber Soul album that weren't on that album. And I figured that they probably were released on a version in the UK. So there were, you know, I think Revolver is largely the same over that across the board. But I think Rubber Soul, there were variations.
Okay. Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah, that always struck me as weird when I found that out. It's like, oh, really? There's the US version, like there's the US albums and there's the UK albums. And once these all came out on CD in 1987, then all the UK versions of the albums became the standard. It became canon across the Beatles. But, you know, before that, it was all kind of up in the air. And the last one is George Martin was actually initially skeptical to have Ringo on the sessions. They recorded a version of Love Me Do with Pete Best. And he was not a great drummer. I mean, he just wasn't. He was speeding up and slowing down. And if you hear it on the Beatles anthology, you can tell, like, he's just not quite getting it. So when they let Pete Best go and Ringo came in, George Martin said to Brian Epstein, he said, look, I don't want to mess around with what you're doing with the stage show. That's fine. But, and you can have Ringo there, but for the recording, I want to bring in a session drummer. And so for the two singles that were actually recorded before the album, Please Please Me and Love Me Do, they have a different drummer, Alan White. And it wasn't until, they realized, oh, Ringo is actually a good drummer.
Is this the Alan White who would go on to play with Yes?
Oh, Andy White. Sorry, Andy White. Yeah, but yeah, no, it's interesting. Like he took a while to come around on Ringo. So
yeah, that's all right.
So there you have it. Those are some interesting facts about the album. So I guess we'll get into the second side of the album. But before we do that, we will hear from our friends over at the Six Picks Music Club. So check that out.
Hey there, I'm Dave, and I host Six Picks Music Club with my two buddies, Jeffro and Russ. We talk about six songs on a playlist that meet a theme, to a topic that we've already decided on.
Just real quick, do you meet themes? Do you meet them?
Okay, no, I don't know. I guess that, what's the...
Russ, could I get a ruling on the verbal phrase, meet the theme?
Jeff, I don't know. I'm not fluent in the spoken word.
People just don't say meet the theme. They say fit a theme. And every week we talk about six songs that fit a theme.
All right. Okay, fit a theme.
Guys, we're going to have to re-record this.
Ah, f*** my d***.
Okay, and Dave, don't forget, it's Six Picks Music Club, not your dark web pod, Sex Picks Booty Grub.
We'll now take a few seconds before we begin side two. Thank you. Here's side two.
Okay, and the ending the album with Twist and Shout. Yeah, I always liked that song. I mean, that was always a great, you know, great rock and roll song. Yeah, this album overall, I think is, you know, it's the first album. Like you said, it's not their best album, but it's a really good place to start, you know?
Yeah, it's a pretty good place to start. The second half of the album has better songs than the first half. I mean, with maybe the exception of like Saw Her Standing There. It's a pretty strong opener. I think the second half is a little stronger. Just the quality of the songs, I think, is a little higher.
You know, leading up to... It's funny, the story of what led up to this album and how the Beatles sort of... Like, before they were famous, and you have all these members that kind of came in and out of the band. You had a guy named Stuart Sutcliffe, who was a friend of John Lennon in art school.
Yeah, he played bass originally.
He played bass, but he wasn't a musician. I mean, he just played bass because they needed a bass player. And it's funny.
Yeah, Paul didn't play bass originally either. He was another guitar player.
No, and you know, it's funny. It's when Stuart Sutcliffe left, they decided to not hire another bass player. They were just going to be a four piece, and because it originally was three guitars and a bass player and a drummer, and you know, both George Harrison and John Lennon said, "Well, I'm not going to play bass." And so Paul, and you know, it's funny.
I would say it's because they were the stronger guitar players, but that's not entirely so either. Cause Paul's a pretty good guitar player,
but he really took to the bass. I mean, you know, these songs, I did watch a YouTube video not too long ago about Paul McCartney's bass lines, and you know, he was not the first melodic bass player, but he certainly, you know, he certainly took to that style of playing.
Yeah, I was listening to, I mean, some of the, like, the guitar solo, I say that, put quotations in that. And, you know, it's just plunk, 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 plunk. And I think that's basically George and John trading off each other, like one's doing sort of a harmony part. But when you listen to the bass in behind, it's way more interesting.
It really is. I mean, you know, early, yeah, like compared to what he would do later on, these bass parts are, you know, relatively simple.
Yeah. But when you really pay attention, there's a lot more going on than you realize.
Yeah, and he really, you know, and that's the funny thing too is when Ringo came into the band, it's interesting how well he fit in and how well he was able to adapt so quickly. Cause it is a really risky thing changing out a drummer, because you really change a lot of the sound of the band when you do that. A bass player and drummer, cause you know, that's the foundation. And so when, you know, you can hear like, even the opening track, I Saw Her Standing There, like Paul and Ringo are just really locked in tight with each other. And I think that a lot of that is because Ringo is such a good drummer.
Yeah, I don't think it would have been able to happen quite the same. I think it was because Paul's a pretty good bass player and he needed a really good drummer to sort of play off of him. When Ringo came in, he's just like, oh, well, this guy knows what he's doing. So they kind of gelled together really well that way. I don't know what the actual politics around this period of the band was. It seems that musically, at least, he sort of found his way into the band through Paul.
Well, what happened was, Ringo was in a band called Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, and they would often be on the same bill as the Beatles, and a lot of the time when Pete Best, you know, couldn't make the gig, they would have Ringo sit in.
Oh, so they're used to playing with him anyway.
Right. And so they were actually a little bit embarrassed because it's like, oh my God, this, when we play with this guy, we sound so much better. And it's like, oh, I wish we could find a good drummer like Ringo. And, you know, that kept happening more and more. And then Brian Epstein one day called up Ringo and said, hey, the band's not playing with Pete Best anymore. Do you want to join? And
Ringo's like, funny. That's funny you say so, because Rory Storm and the Hurricanes is dissolved.
Well, no, actually I've heard Ringo tell this story a few times. Is this was on a Wednesday, and he says, "Well, I can't join now. How about I join on Saturday?" Because he thought that by not joining until Saturday, that was giving Rory Storm and the Hurricanes enough time to find a new drummer. It's like 3 days,
oh, okay.
4 days or whatever. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, the history, you know, shows he joined the Beatles and that was it. But yeah, no, he just fit in with them so well. And I can imagine how happy they were when it's like, oh, okay, he's the guy, you know, and the other thing too, is like, Pete Best didn't really fit in with them, like socially. When they got the famous Beatle haircut, he still had a pompadour. And so it's like, you know, this guy, he's just not. And that's what, you know, a lot of being a musician, what they call is being a good hang, is just, easy to be around.
You could argue that the Beatles haircut was a little bit silly to begin with, but the pompadour is kind of silly to begin with too, when you really think about it. But a lot of these trendy trends are.
Yeah. Well, the pompadour was kind of going out of style.
Yeah. It wasn't,
you know, that was more of a 50s thing.
Absolutely. But it was still pretty common in the 60s and amongst the, the rock and roll set in the early, like the Teddy Boy set in the, late 50s, early 60s, of which, you know, John Lennon certainly was, and many of his friends were at the time. That was what he had as well. The Beatles haircut didn't really even come along until after they'd already established themselves.
Well, sort of happened in when they went to Hamburg, because they had a friend named Klaus Voormann who had that style, and they said, oh, you know, we like that, can you his girlfriend, I think her name is Astrid, she cut their hair like that, but Pete didn't want his hair cut like that. So he was always I'm not saying that that's really a big deal, but it's just like, he's not really fitting in with everybody.
Yeah, I mean, could be. Again, I don't know exactly what went on with Pete and stuff. I've read books and stuff like that, but again, and it's funny how little Pete actually comes up in some of these books. So I think that sort of reflects that sometimes. It's just Pete was kind of doing his own thing while they were kind of being a group. Not to knock Pete. Pete, you're pretty awesome. I mean, you had to be you started out in the Beatles.
Yeah. Yeah. That's got to count for something.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think this album overall, I mean, the production is pretty bare bones. They're just, you know, playing it live. It has a certain charm to it, I think. If I had to pick my favorite three songs, I think I would probably go with, I'd probably go with I Saw Her Standing There. There's a Place. And probably Twist and Shout.
Yeah, I'm kind of in those things either. But if I were to avoid, you know, the popular choice of Twist and Shout, but I think I'm probably going to include it. I'm going to say probably. I kind of liked Baby It's You. That's pretty good. You Want to Know Seek's pretty good too. But I think I'm going to pick Baby It's You. There's a Place, because they just do a good job of that. And Twist and Shout is the Isley Brothers song. So,
yeah.
Really good.
Yeah. So I guess that brings, like, would you listen to this album again?
I mean, probably. There's nothing actually wrong with it, but I'm way more likely to listen to the later stuff.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with this album. It's just, there, as far as the Beatles go, there's more interesting stuff. And that's not to say this is a bad album. In fact, you could argue that this album, I think maybe if they hadn't, if this was their only album, I would say this is a pretty damn good album. If for whatever reason they never became a hit, and or they only had a few hits early in their career and they only recorded this album, I would say, hey, you know, it's a good album.
Yeah, I'd say this is a pretty good you know, collection of songs for that unknown band, the Beatles, you know, from the early 60s. They put out this really weird, obscure album that, you know, and it's just, yeah.
I think I would listen to it again, you know, if I'm in the mood for their early stuff. Yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess we'll end the episode there. Thank you so much for listening if you made it this far. You know, you can connect with us in a couple of different ways. We do have a subreddit. You can go to reddit.com/, it's just r/polyphonicpress. And you can follow us on Instagram as well. And you can... if you want to help us out, you can go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress. You can get these episodes a day before they go live, and you can, you know, chat with other fans and us as well there. And you can even pick an album for us to review. So that's lots of fun as well. All of those links are in the description. And I think that just about does it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.